The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 4, our mini-series on medical education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoipine, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Khrushnevskaya. We are so excited to be back recording, back sharing episodes with you, and really thrilled to talk about learner autonomy on today's show with our guest, Dr. Ben Kinnear. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
Sure, Molly. We are the health professions podcast for all things medical education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of medical educators. And we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Ben Kinnear, today. We cover the definitions of autonomy, supervision, all things risk tolerance, how to promote autonomy, and really have a nuanced conversation on how to do that as an educator.
Dr. Ben Kinnear is a MedPeds hospitalist in Cincinnati, Ohio, and is the Associate Program Director for the MedPeds and IM residency programs. His interests include competency-based medical education, novel assessment strategies, evidence-based learning, and coaching. He is currently a PhD candidate at Maastricht University School of Health Professions Education, where he is studying validity, argumentation, and argumentation theory. Ben spends most of his free time with his wife and two daughters hiking, playing board games, and telling amazing dad jokes.
We're excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. This is a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to all our Patreon members as well. If you love the Curbsiders family and their content and haven't joined yet, please consider supporting us in continuing to create this amazing content. So without further ado, let's get to it.
Dr. Kinnear, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Listeners may remember you from our amazing episode all the way back in season one on competency-based time variable medical education. For this recording, are you okay if we call you Ben again?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thank you. So we just wanted to get a little update from you. What's been new in the last 2 years? Any personal or professional updates that you'd like to share?
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me back. Really excited to be here. I was telling you both before we started recording that I'm a huge fan of the podcast. I would say, for the most part, not a whole lot has changed. I still spend most of my time chasing around my kids. I have an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old. And one of the most exciting things for me in my personal life is they're both theater kids now. My 8-year-old is playing Dory in Finding Nemo, and she's a fantastic Dory. And my oldest daughter, who's 12, is in the ensemble of Rock of Ages. So my house right now is filled with my 12-year-old screaming 80s rock ballads, which just fills my bucket every day. And then professionally, you know, not a whole lot has changed since we last spoke. I'm still plugging away on my PhD, which hopefully someday will come to an end. And I think the most exciting thing is there's a group of really amazing folks here in Cincinnati who just started a new education lab. And we're calling it RADICAL, which stands for Research and Assessment Designed to Improve Care and Learning. And so we just launched this lab, and we've got some really awesome folks with a diverse set of talents, and we're going to try to improve patient care through education. So those, I think, are the big updates.
That's amazing. I feel like you always come up with the best acronyms. I think between RADICAL, INSPIRE,
timeless,
all the things, timeless. Yes. I think there's just like such a win for you in that vein.
Oh, well, that one was not me. That one was Eric Warm. And I think he had an assist from his wife on that one too. But everyone knows you can't have a project will not succeed unless you have a good acronym, just like a good cardiac trial. You know, you got to have the acronym first.
And how's Timeless going?
You know, we are still unpacking all the data we collected from the initial pilot, which ran 2.5 years. We paused the pilot for now while we are doing all the analysis, which is taking a while because it's all qualitative. One of the things that we are keeping it paused for right now is, as we thought about time variable training, one of the pieces that has become more and more important in my mind is the equity piece. I think I mentioned this on the previous podcast, but while we spent a lot of time on our validity argument, in other words, an argument for the fact that our decisions were defensible in terms of readiness for practice, we had not collected a lot of evidence about equity of our decisions and are we disadvantaging any particular group of learners based on their identity. And so we didn't pause because we found evidence of inequity, but I feel like the burden of proof should be on us to show that we are making equitable decisions. And that's actually sparked some really interesting ideas and work around how do we do a better job developing that evidence. So that's where we are right now. We have one other qualitative study that we're almost finished with the analysis phase. And then the work will be around how do we develop evidence that those decisions are equitable and then restarting the pilot.
Well, we'll be looking out for those publications as they come down the line. I know you have a pick of the week. So what have you got for us today?
Molly, how'd you know? I'm going to go a little bit rogue, which is that I'm having a pick of the week, which is a book that I'm actively still reading, but I've been so impressed by it that I had to share it. And probably everyone on this call has either already read it or has already heard about it. But it's the latest from Barbara Kingsolver, Demon Copperhead. It's actually a 2022 book and won the 2023 Pulitzer for fiction. But it's especially kind of close to my heart because it follows a geographic area that was close to where I grew up. So basically, she writes about a boy named Damon Fields, but he goes by Demon Copperhead, or gets that nickname, in kind of Southwest Virginia. So the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia, which is very close to where I grew up, and just kind of winds us through his childhood, kind of teenage years and afterwards, and really just is an incredible story. But I think one thing that's especially powerful for me is, as somebody who takes care of patients with substance use disorders, there's a lot around addiction and kind of the intersecting worlds of poverty, addiction, race, kind of socioeconomic class, all these things. And also reading about it, I'm like, how does Barbara Kingsolver know what an 11-year-old boy is thinking, or like how he's describing his kind of experiences? It's wild. And I'm actually audibling it. So I'm hearing the amazing kind of narration of, I think his name is Charlie. I'm forgetting his last name at this moment in time. But bottom line is, it's an incredible read/listen, and I would highly recommend it. I don't know if either of you have read it.
I have not, but she's an amazing author.
It sounds incredible.
Yeah. The story is super powerful. What about you, Molly? Tell us your pick of the week, if you have one.
My pick of the week is a little lighter. It's a show I've been watching with my older son on Netflix called The School of Chocolate. And it brings in this group of people who have some experience with kind of creating pastries and desserts, but not a significant amount. You know, they're certainly not professionals. And then they get these challenges. It's a reality baking cooking show. But they also get a lot of education along the way. And being an educational nerd, it was kind of fun to see sort of their approaches to the people who are struggling, and like giving them extra time to build their skills and giving them more support rather than the typical reality show where they just get knocked down and kicked out. So it's fun. They make amazing chocolate sculptures, and I certainly won't be trying any of the techniques at home, but definitely fun to watch.
It's amazing how those reality shows are so much more enjoyable when they're supportive and kind rather than the kind of mean ones, you know? Like, I feel like baking shows are pretty good at that. They tend to be like a supportive community, it seems like. So,
yes, I was totally late to the game for Great British Baking Show. And I'm like, oh my God, everyone's so nice. And they're hugging each other. And they're like, you did so well. And we're going to learn together. And then they get back together and they stay in contact. And I was like, wow, is this what it's like outside of American reality shows? Yikes. Alas.
Well, let's jump into our case. Ira, do you want to kick us off?
Totally. So our case from Cashlock Memorial, Rena is a junior faculty in a clinic where she has the opportunity to work with and supervise learners of all levels. She spends 3 days a week with her own patients in primary care, and then a full day where she's precepting residents and interns, and then in the morning, and then medical students in the afternoon. So Rena comes to you, Ben, as a mid-career mentor to pick your brain. How can she empower her learners and also develop trust in them, such that they are ready for more potentially autonomy based on their level of development? And we're so excited to have you back because we know that you have an incredible approach that you're going to teach us to this. But wondering, when you're thinking about a conversation like this one with Rena, we included a lot of buzzwords in this case, you know, trust, empowerment, entrustment, learner autonomy. How do you think about these words? How do they fit together? What's kind of going through your mind in this multiple stacked question?
Yeah. So to me, the first thing is I would tell Rena, I would give her massive kudos for being so deliberate about it. One of the trickiest things about autonomy in our field is that it's kind of invisible to us. It's implicit in all the decisions that we make. So the fact that she is, you know, seeking advice on how to be deliberate and to do this well is the first thing to just kind of say good job there. I do think that there are a lot of words that get conflated and used even when describing one another. And the two that I would start out with trying to tease apart would be autonomy and supervision. So autonomy, the way I think about it is it's almost an internal sense or feeling that someone has that they have agency or volition or ability to act in the world. Supervision is actually an external thing. It is how much someone else is monitoring what you're doing. They're overseeing what you're doing. They're stepping in when they need to step in to make sure that things are getting done or that patients are safe. And so you can imagine these two things are closely related, supervision and autonomy, but that they are somewhat independently titratable variables in terms of how we're going about managing our teams and enacting supervision. So that would be the first thing I would try to tease apart. You mentioned the word trust and entrustment. I think those are two other things I would try to tease out. The word trust actually implies a sense of vulnerability. So if you're going to trust someone, you have to be vulnerable to their actions. And usually we are thinking about actions related to patient care or something else on the team. The example I would give is if I'm sitting and having lunch with my 8-year-old and I'm just eating a sandwich next to her, she's not trusting me to eat that sandwich because there's no, like, you know, there's no vulnerability there. There's nothing bad that's going to happen because I'm eating my sandwich. If I'm pushing her on the swings, she's trusting me to push her on the swings because if I push her too hard, she's going to go flying off or flip backwards or something like that. So there has to be that element of vulnerability or risk. Otherwise, there really is no actual trust there. Entrustment is the act of giving trust to someone else, which means you are being vulnerable in the moment to their actions. And the way we usually use that in medical education is we are being vulnerable to another's actions in patient care. And often that plays out by decreasing the supervision that they are getting with a given task. So to put them all together, autonomy is the internal sense that someone has, and we can foster a sense of autonomy or we can squash a sense of autonomy in the clinical learning environment. Supervision is the actual way that oversight is carried out, and we can also, you know, have more or less supervision. And entrustment is an act that comes with the act of decreasing supervision because we are being vulnerable to our learners or to other people on the care team by kind of taking our hands off the wheel a little bit and giving them space. So that's how I think about those variables fitting together. And I think it is important, especially with that autonomy versus supervision piece, to have people think about those things a little bit separately, even though they're related, because sometimes supervision is not something we can change very much of. But autonomy is something I think as educators, we have a lot of control over in the clinical learning environment and even outside the clinical learning environment.
I think that's so helpful. Thank you, Ben. That really clarifies it. Because before I was really thinking deeply about this, I definitely conflated autonomy with sort of lack of supervision. And I think that is really helpful to separate them out a little bit. In thinking about autonomy as kind of this internal locus of control, how does that fit in with the self-determination theory? And how does that allow the learner's autonomy to help them grow?
Oh, I love that you brought up self-determination theory. Remind me, have you all covered this on your podcast before?
We have not. So a brief overview would be wonderful.
Okay, great. So self-determination theory, it's one of my favorite med ed theories, which, you know, just there's a lot of them out there that I really love. But the reason I love it is because it is so practical to try to use as an educator, because some theories seem very ethereal. This one's very practical. And at its core, self-determination theory is a theory on human motivation. And what it says is that we all kind of sit on a spectrum somewhere, most of us anyway, from intrinsically motivated to extrinsically motivated. And ideally, as educators, we want people to be intrinsically motivated. We don't want to have to use carrots and sticks to get people to be interested in learning and growing and those kinds of things. And to foster intrinsic motivation, self-determination theory says that humans have three psychological needs. And those needs are a sense of competence, a sense of relatedness, and a sense of autonomy. which is obviously what we're talking about today. And so if we want to foster intrinsic motivation for things like self-regulated learning and self-directed learning and all those kinds of things, then we have to foster a sense of autonomy within our learners. We have to help them feel like they have agency, both in the clinical care that they're delivering, but also in their own learning. So it's not just about autonomy in the clinical care that they're giving. It's also about autonomy and how they're driving their own learning over time. So it's really important not only for, well, there's lots of reasons why promoting autonomy, but it really is linked closely to motivation of learners. And you can see this, I'm sure you've experienced this, where a learner, you could just see the motivation deflate from them as soon as they lose their sense of autonomy on rounds. And sometimes it can be a very small event that does it. I've seen some residents when, you know, they want to order one type of IV fluid and their attending or their fellow says, no, let's do this type of fluid, when it really probably didn't matter. And you could just see the kind of intrinsic motivation deflate out of them. And I think as we get further along in our careers, sometimes we forget that feeling. We kind of have like an empathy gap with our learners and don't realize, like, in those moments, that's where you can build a sense of autonomy. So it's so important just to keep people engaged in wanting to grow and build their identity as a clinician.
Thank you so much for that, Ben. And I think even if we, you know, have previously covered it, this is a nice way to revisit it and revisit it in a deeper way. I wonder, when you have moments when you like can see the intrinsic motivation leaving someone's body, have you had a time where you've like named that or been kind of in a place where maybe you're supervising or you're observing and there is a place where you can kind of bring this theory honestly to life? Because, you know, we joked earlier, like, this is practical to use as opposed to some of the other ones that are not as, and just wondering kind of in a quick tangent, if there was a time where you brought this and words into the space.
Yes. And in fact, I also was that learner. I was the learner who wanted autonomy at every turn. And if I said I wanted to give lactated ringers and my attending said no normal saline, I would, you know, just be totally miffed about it the rest of the day. What helped me when I was a resident was to then debrief about that later with my attending. And so that's what I do now. I try not to call it out in the moment because that could be, you know, maybe not the safest environment to talk about someone's reaction. But, you know, if that happens, whether it's something that I have done or if I see another person on the team kind of squashing someone's sense of autonomy, I'll pull them aside later and I'll usually describe the behaviors that I saw. So I'll say, hey, I noticed your whole body language changed in that moment in the room. And can you tell me what you were thinking or feeling as that was unfolding? And most of the time, residents who are feeling frustrated with not having a sense of autonomy are more than happy to share with you why they are feeling that way. And now remember, I'm an internist and a pediatrician, so I can mostly only speak to the culture in internal medicine and in pediatrics. So it might be very different in other specialties, but a lot of times if somebody is visibly showing frustration on rounds, they are ready to unpack it with you afterwards. So I think one of the common themes for all of this discussion is just to be very explicit with your communication with your learners about what you're trying to do with the autonomy you're trying to give them, but also what is their sense of how things are going. And if they're feeling like you're stepping all over their toes, then let them share their experience and then you can adjust accordingly.
Totally. And I guess just bringing it back to, you know, you were speaking about how you have this experience relative to internal medicine and pediatrics and mostly with residents. I wonder if you kind of can think broadly about how self-determination theory or this kind of goal of promoting autonomy can be applied broadly in the larger context of health professions education.
Yes. I think that with regard to autonomy more broadly, even outside of physician training, I think one of the interesting things to consider is how differently autonomy probably manifests between specialties. I mean, again, as a med peds doc, the way autonomy is both thought about and enacted is very different in the internal medicine world than it is in the pediatrics world. And that's just two relatively closely related specialties. And then we've all seen autonomy be very differently enacted on different rotations within those specialties, right? It looks different in the ICU than it does on a ward team, than it does on a consult team, and it varies by attending and all sorts of things. So then if you broaden things out to include, you know, nursing and pharmacy and physician assistants, I actually have no idea how autonomy is conceptualized or enacted or what the expectations are in those fields. And I'm guessing most of us as physicians don't. So this probably calls to the fore, like how important interprofessional education is, because I mean, I don't know if you were ever in this position as a learner or if you've seen this play out, but you know, we've had it happen where our learners are at the bedside with a concern that a bedside nurse might have. In that moment, maybe there's not a complete agreement on the plan and the nurse will escalate it to the person above the resident. And to the resident, that is like a sin of the highest order, right? It is very frustrating to be stepped over and go to your fellow or your attending, even though that might be the right thing to do for that patient. And it's because we hold the sense of autonomy so dear to who we are as physicians, but it may not be that same way in other professions. What might be seen as like a kind of a egregious, you know, overreach to us might be very different in other professional worlds. So I actually don't have a great sense of how it manifests in other places, but I think we should have a sense of humility and curiosity when we're working in interprofessional teams and we make assumptions about how people are, you know, treating our autonomy in that space when it may be very different in other fields and how autonomy plays out.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I think as physicians, we are, it's kind of held on this pedestal that we get to this place of autonomy. And I hadn't really reflected on that culture may be different in other specialties or other professions.
Can you think of a moment when you were learners or even now that you had your autonomy kind of squashed and you just had that like anger build up inside of you? I had lots of those as a resident.
I can think of when I was in my continuity clinic in third year and we had these little paper books and we had to like have the attending sign off that someone had witnessed me do a heart exam or witnessed me do like a diabetic foot exam. And I was like, I'm ready to graduate. I'm ready to go into practice. I don't want you to sign off on my little book. And it felt very, very frustrating. But now as an attending, I'm like, of course I need to see what you guys are doing. And that's why I'm here.
Totally, totally. I had a similar experience in clinic where I was like, I'm just trying to manage this person's hypothyroidism. Like, it doesn't matter if we, you know, like it was like micro minutia change, like difference, like going up from like, I don't know, 88 micrograms to 112. And the person was like, why don't we just have them take an extra one on Sunday? And I was like, yeah, that's another way of doing that. Okay. You know, you just sit there and you're like, I'm not sure it matters. And then now as the attending, I'm like, I obviously know that I want them to take another tablet on Sunday, but I can't, I like sit there and I'm like, how is it worth it to sit there and like change this plan? Or do we just see how it goes and let them have this moment? And it is a constant question. And I have to remind myself, like, think back, Ira, think when you were, you know, a third year and you just couldn't, you were like, really, it's what you said earlier, Ben, about you could see it, it's like written on your face, it's body language, you couldn't handle it, but you know, you're about to do that to somebody else. Like, is it necessary? So.
Yeah. And you all are dedicated educators. So you're always thinking about that and your learners' needs. But I think there are so many supervisors who maybe aren't thinking about that in that same way. Again, especially because your perspective does change on what's happening in that moment when you get further into your career and you're a supervisor and you lose a little bit of that rage that you feel when somebody's altering your plan. And so I think if there's a way we can keep like bottle that experience and open it back up just in those moments to remind us what that learner might be experiencing, it's so helpful.
Zooming back to our case with Raina. So she's, you know, coming to talk to you because she's having these sort of challenges between balancing how does she approach autonomy with her medical student versus with her residents. How do you think about it kind of based on the different level of learner? And I believe most of your work is with residents. So if you don't feel like you can speak as much to the medical student piece, that's okay. But
no, I think this is a great question. And you all know that I feel really strongly that there is a lot of inter-learner variability in terms of competence and confidence and professional identity formation. And so while I think using the level they're at, like a third year medical student versus an AI versus a resident, I think that's a good starting point. But really the only way to know how much autonomy somebody wants or needs is to really ask. Because you're going to have some really advanced medical students or you're going to have some residents who maybe are not feeling as confident and autonomous in a given setting. And so early on when you meet with your learners and you're setting those expectations, that's a great place to start asking questions that might tip off how much autonomy they want. Is this their first time in your specialty? Is this their first time in this clinical environment? Or what types of things are you feeling confident about and you want to take a little bit more autonomy in your work? Or what areas are you not as confident and you want to not have as much autonomy in your decision making? I mean, I think those are really simple questions to ask and are probably better to help titrate to what each learner needs than just presuming where they are in their training.
I love how simple you made it of just ask the learner kind of where they, how much autonomy they want or where they want more autonomy or less autonomy. Does that work well for you? Do you feel like most of your learners are able to articulate that? I think about it kind of on the continuum of like, what are your goals for today? And some learners come in and they're like, do, you know, these three things I want feedback on. And other times they're just like, I don't know, you know, been in the ICU all weekend. I don't even want to think about it. Do you feel like most learners are able to articulate how much autonomy they want or where they want more?
Yeah, I think to your point, I think many of them are not able to say, here's all the areas where I want autonomy, but most people can give you one or two things that they are most interested in trying to take the lead on the decision-making. And a good entry point is saying, what would you like to work on this week? That usually is an indication of something where they want to do active work and make those decisions. So is it running a rapid response? Is it managing antibiotics for different cases? Is it doing pap smears? Those kinds of things. However, all of us, ourselves and the learners we work with, sometimes lack insight into where we are ready for autonomy and where we are not ready for autonomy. And that's a challenging moment when there's a disagreement in how much autonomy someone should have, both for their own personal growth and for patient safety. So sometimes you can use indirect cues like, are things falling through the cracks? Are patient encounters not going very well? Is a resident looking really stressed out? Or is your team kind of not functioning efficiently and well? Those are sometimes clues that despite the fact that somebody wants autonomy, that maybe they're not ready for it in that moment. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll open those conversations with the behavior that I saw. Like, hey, I noticed we rounded for a really long time today. And I think it's because X, Y, and Z happened. Let's try to unpack that. Or, you know, I noticed that some of the orders that we were hoping to place or the transfer for this patient didn't happen in a timely fashion. Can we talk about what might have led to that? And sometimes we don't get to the actual word autonomy, but we start to get it into like their decision making and how much support they might need or how much they might need to run something by myself or a fellow. I think that's a good entry point into it. But I don't think we can only ask, what do you want in terms of autonomy? Because while giving them that autonomy is important, it also is helpful to serve as a mirror to reflect back, like, what are we seeing in terms of actual behavior and performance too? I think one other thing that makes medical students a little bit different is that there's real risk to autonomy to medical students in a certain way. So if you think about it, you know, a lot of what, especially in the clerkship year, what medical students are doing is they're performing because so much of their future depends on the grade that they get, especially at institutions where there are tiered grading systems like honors and high pass and all those kinds of things. So with autonomy comes risk of finding the edges of your competence, right? I think if you try to have a lot of autonomy and you make a mistake, which we might get to later, but is, you know, mistakes and failure are part and parcel with autonomy, then that creates risk for you rather than, you know, taking minimal amounts of autonomy and just doing your job well. So that's a risk that residents may feel a little bit less because most residencies don't have grades and they've already, you know, matched into their residency program. So another thing to consider is just that autonomy, while it is, I think, really useful for growth and learning, in some settings where there's not psychological safety or where grades are looming over everything, could present risk to students. And that's another place where you would want to ask them, where do you want to have more autonomy as we move along in the clinical environment?
I appreciate you naming that, Ben, because I think there is this moment where you're realizing like there is a difference between autonomy for a medical student and autonomy for a resident or graduate kind of level trainee. And what does it mean to understand where the risk is and kind of where finding that, we'll say, growth edge or competence edge is, and kind of who potentially is a stakeholder in that risk calculus, because there's a lot of people involved, and the patient among them, especially with a student and kind of their performance trajectory, as opposed to necessarily with a resident, where there is a kind of the patient's obviously involved and there is a maybe a component of performance, but I think it's a larger maybe risk with the student.
Yeah, I was actually just, there was a med-ed journal club that some second year medical students had here recently, and I was lucky enough to get to go. And they were talking about their internal experiences as they were doing this OSCE program that they have here. It's a really well-run OSCE program, and it has nothing to do with their grades. This isn't even tied to grades. And they talked about how some of them burst into tears on, they would do their OSCE and then they would come up with a plan. And then as they were reading the OSCE rater's face, if the face was not like welcoming and encouraging, then some of them immediately thought I failed and they like burst into tears because it felt like so high pressure, even though, again, no grade attached to this. And I think the OSCE raters were trying to just not give anything away with their facial expressions. But that just shows you like the internal pressure that I think our students feel. And so I think we should promote autonomy. To do so, obviously, we have to promote psychological safety and just recognize that in some ways, there is tangible risk to going out on a limb and making autonomous decisions where you know failure can happen when you're in that student space. It shouldn't be that way, but that's just kind of the reality of the systems that we have set up, unfortunately.
You know, we've talked a little bit about the benefits of learner autonomy in terms of self-determination theory and feeling that onus to be able to grow on your own and be able to develop. What are some of the other benefits in terms of learner autonomy?
Oh, so many. So we already mentioned motivation and finding their ability. I think one of the big benefits of trying to foster autonomy while you're still in training is if you are going to have autonomy in your decision-making and in your choices, you are going to feel a greater sense of responsibility for those choices. And when you make those decisions that you're unsure if they're correct, and you just have to sit in that soup of uncertainty while you wait to see what plays out with your patient, I think that's a really formative thing to go through while you're still in a place with mentorship and support, like being in residency or being in medical school. One of the hardest things for me becoming an attending was when you make those decisions without supervision for the first time, and you're like, oh my gosh, did I make the right decision? And you're like logging into the electronic health record over and over and over to see, like, you know, watch the vital signs, see what happens, find that lab. I think the more autonomy our learners feel, the more connected they feel to those types of decisions. And let's help them make that transition, which is really uncomfortable while they're still in training. I also think that autonomy is a great way to build confidence. So most of us have imposter syndrome. If we are not giving people autonomy in their decision-making, it's hard to break through that wall of imposter syndrome when you're going on to work without supervision. And then I think a couple of other things. I think fostering autonomy and learning is really important because if we want people to continue to be self-directed learners after training, when those guardrails are gone, we have to give them that sense of autonomy and agency while they're in training. I don't know if y'all have seen the work of Anders Ericsson and some of these other deliberate practice kind of studies, but if we don't continue being deliberate with our learning after training, we will become experienced non-experts.
Yes.
If we want to be true experts, we have to continue with that effortful, deliberate learning, even after we are not required to by residency or fellowship or any of those things. So I think autonomy as a learner, as part of your identity, will actually help people not become deliberate non-experts, but will help them continue to be experts afterwards. And then the last thing I'll just say is, I think autonomy is good for our patients because, you know, when people talk about autonomy and then kind of the corollary supervision, which we talk about, it's often framed as like patient safety, which is true. But the reality is most of our trainees are just really good clinicians. And sometimes it's better if we step back and let them cook, you know, like it's good for patients when people with really brilliant ideas who maybe know newer therapies even better than I do, if we give them the space to do their thing, maybe we're not actually the all-knowing safeguards that we think we are all the time. And if we give our learners some space, they'll do some great things for our patients.
I like that because I think patient safety is often framed as one of the reasons why we should be careful about autonomy. And I appreciate that reframing as it is a positive because I certainly know many of my learners are smarter than I am. And many of them have, you know, had exposure to things that I don't see in primary care. And I think it helps us all learn together. Another kind of downside I've seen to promoting autonomy is sort of reduced trainee feedback. And I think some of that is conflating the autonomy with supervision to say that if there's more autonomy, there's less supervision, and then it may be harder to give feedback. But do you see that as a concern with increasing autonomy, or are there other concerns that you see coming out of increased autonomy?
Yeah, I think that's not quite true. I do think if you reduce your supervision and your observation, you might have trouble giving feedback. But it's hard to get feedback if you don't give people autonomy because you're not really seeing their decisions and their choices. So in my mind, the more agency you give someone, the easier it is to give feedback because then you're actually seeing their actual work rather than, you know, them just echoing what you want to have done. But there are definitely challenges to giving your learners autonomy. I think that other than patient safety, I think time is a big factor because if you want to let people have autonomy in their decision-making and in their choices, sometimes that takes time to work through, especially those nuanced and challenging decisions. And we're all on the clock on rounds or in clinic or in the OR. and really giving people room to struggle and think and debate can be kind of hard. Sometimes we're like, okay, let's just go. Just choose this option. And we have to, again, make sure that if we're going to actually try to promote autonomy, that we give people that space. And I think managing our own emotions is hard. Some of us are pretty risk averse, and some of us are more risk tolerant. Some of us are more flexible or less flexible. And even trying to keep track of all of this is a lot of cognitive load while we're also managing patients, also trying to observe skills, also trying to, you know, manage the team. And all of those things, I think, are challenges in trying to do well in terms of giving the right amount of autonomy for learner growth, especially when we're on teams with multiple learners who all need different amounts of autonomy or have different experiences of what's going on. So it's really challenging, not to mention that while you can promote autonomy without reducing supervision, there does come a point where the only way to give more autonomy is to reduce supervision, especially for our more advanced learners. And so sometimes it's the constraints of our training system that we're not allowed to reduce supervision to actually promote more autonomy. We ran into this a little bit in our Timeless program, where we were under the constraints of certifying bodies to make sure that people were still supervised by an attending until they fully graduated. And so we had to try to kind of mimic unsupervised practice without truly having unsupervised practice, but it wasn't the same. There's something really, truly important when somebody's ready for reduced supervision as their journey in autonomy goes, that you can actually give them that experience. And if I could tie it back to one of the words we talked about earlier, entrustment, there are some really thoughtful researchers who are talking about this in the entrustment world, that there is a difference between entrustment decisions and entrustment determinations. And the distinction that they draw is that entrustment determinations are when we say, I would trust you to do this thing with less supervision, but it's a hypothetical because we know it's not going to happen. An entrustment decision is, I am going to trust you to do this thing with lesser supervision. I'm actually going to put consequences to the decision, which again, the constraints of our system does not always allow. But in reality, if we're going to make a true entrustment decision, not just a determination, the decision should have consequences to it. And so that's another really hard thing to manage, is how do we actually titrate the supervision when we think somebody's ready for that in their autonomy journey?
Well, I think that's a great place, Ben, if we can like take a step back in terms of what you just mentioned and the autonomy journey for us as, let's say, faculty or observers or supervisors, in the goal of not being deliberate, not experts, but instead being the people who kind of are helping residents get to, you know, as the ACGME program requirements tell us, we got to get to a place where people are comfortable in autonomous clinical practice. How do you kind of encourage other faculty really to help a learner across this kind of autonomy journey? Meaning, like, is there a framework that you tell people to focus on? Like, if we were talking to Rena right now and she was like, Ben, how do I do this though? You know, like, is there a framework I lean on? Is there a place where self-determination theory has been kind of mapped to particular developmental levels? Like, how would we really do this and enact kind of that titration of supervision along the autonomy journey?
Yeah, I think one framework that is commonly used, we've already mentioned, that I think lends itself to this really well, is the whole idea of entrustment and EPAs. So entrustment is usually enacted using what's called entrustment supervision scales, where the way we assess our learners is all about how much supervision they needed for a given task. Now, that's not autonomy. As we said, they're different, but they're very related. And I think it starts to ground people's thinking in terms of how much autonomy did that learner have and how much supervision did they need. So sometimes we can set up our assessment systems to ground us in that type of thinking and make us be more deliberate. I think it's easier to do that if you're actually making entrustment decisions and there's consequences to them and not just entrustment determinations. But for Rena, I think one of the frameworks that I've heard out there, I think this came from the Medical College of Wisconsin, is the four S's. And it's kind of a mnemonic to think about, how do I promote autonomy for my learner? And the four S's are silence, second, safety, and secret moves. So let me just say what each one of those are. So silence is what you would think it is. It's not my space to talk. I'm going to redirect conversation with the family and decision-making and questions to my learner. I'm not going to jump in and interrupt. I'm going to give them space. I'm genuinely going to let them take the time that they need to make those decisions rather than just jumping in and kind of taking over. Even when things get a little bit dicey, you're going to allow some risk on those high-risk conversations or decisions. Second is, in everything, you should let your learners be the leaders. So they should enter the room first. They should introduce themselves first, give their opinions first. And frankly, I think even just positioning yourself in a room, whether it's in clinic or on rounds, is really important to make yourself the non-dominant person that everybody talks to. I'm really tall, and so I always stand in the back corner, and sometimes I even squat on rounds because I've got this giant neck and I stick up above everybody else. So I try to get out of line of sight. And my learners sometimes joke that I'm having tet spells on rounds because I'm trying to just get out of everyone's view. Safety is, again, what we talked about with that psychological safety. And this is where the whole idea of yes and comes in. So if you want to promote their autonomy, the easiest way to shut that down is to tell somebody no. But if any of you've done improv, one of the rules of improv is always say yes and rather than no but. So if somebody says, hey, I think we should use this antibiotic, instead of saying no, you could say, yes, that antibiotic would cover some of the bacteria we're concerned about. And there's another antibiotic that might be better in this situation, and here's why. And then the fourth one is what they call secret moves, which is essentially how can you facilitate the team and discussion and efficiency without letting residents know that you're doing it. So nudging the team along, making sure that you're encouraging your learners to teach one another and those kind of things without you taking those roles and not letting them know that you're kind of pulling the levers behind the scenes. So silence, second, safety, and secret moves. If you can kind of keep those in your back pocket, you're probably going to create an environment where people are going to feel like they have some autonomy in the clinical space.
I like that. I'm not sure about secret moves, but I mean, I like the idea of it, but the choice of words is a little bit.
Yeah, it's a weird term.
But yeah. I kind of love it, though. I feel like, Molly, you had some secret, you know, autonomy promoting moves up your sleeve, I feel.
I don't know, but but I think in general, those are really nice to make sure you're giving the learner space to fully give their presentation, not interrupting, really giving them time to kind of put their money down on what they want their next step of the plan to be. And as long as it's reasonably safe to allow them to move forward with that. Do you have any specific tips for attendings who are maybe more on the micromanaging side, res attending, you know, having trouble stepping back from that a little bit?
Yes. And that was definitely me early on in my career. I think one of the first things to ask is, why are you that way? Why are you doing that? And a lot of times I think it's because as an attending, we are ourselves not comfortable in that clinical moment, or we have been burned by that particular, you know, that person with chest pain where we did not get the CT scan to look for the PE that sticks in our mind. So usually there's some sort of cognitive bias or heuristic that's manifesting, or, you know, I tend to be much more micromanagey where we have a condition that I'm not as familiar with. That's how it can manifest. So I think just having that moment of reflection is really important. And then the best way is to ask for feedback. So ask your learners, hey, just pull them aside after rounds. Hey, how did I do today on rounds? Was I stepping on your toes too much? Did you have space to make decisions? You know, or what can I do better? Or even call out a space like, hey, I felt like maybe I jumped in a little too early here. What do you think? How did I do there? And then I know not all programs have this, but getting feedback from your peers is really helpful. At Cincinnati Children's, we have a program where a few times a year, one of my hospital medicine colleagues will come and just watch me on rounds. And their whole goal is not to watch the learners, but to watch me and give me feedback after rounds. And it's really, I think, helpful to see what our peers are doing and to get feedback from one another. Because I don't know about you all, but once I finish training, I have no idea how I'm doing compared to my peers. Like, am I a micromanager or not? I don't even know anymore because you kind of lose a sense of that. And nobody's giving you feedback other than learners. And as we all know, sometimes it's hard for learners to give honest feedback to their supervisors. So peer feedback is helpful. And then just getting as much feedback from your learners as possible is really important.
And kind of thinking about autonomy more broadly again, we know that there's disparities in many aspects of medicine, autonomy included. And there was a recent publication by Lund et al. That looked at kind of sex and gender related differences on autonomy. How do we kind of address these disparities in autonomy and work to overcome them? Or how can an educator be more intentional about trying to reduce disparities in autonomy?
This is such an important question. And I think it ties to disparities that we see in assessment and all sorts of stuff. And, we mentioned the Timeless pilot that we had. This all ties together of how do we do a better job being intentional about this. I do not think there is an easy fix. And some of the kind of baseline things we can do would be things like implicit bias training and things like that. But I don't think rater training and supervisor training can fix everything. I don't believe we can de-bias people. But I think two strategies that might help would be, one, this idea of reflexivity. So in qualitative research, there's something that people usually talk about, which is their reflexivity statement, where they explicitly talk about the identities and beliefs and backgrounds that they are bringing to the research study. And they write what's called a reflexivity statement. And I think that supervisor, like faculty development, should include training on how to have a moment of reflexivity in the clinical space to say, okay, I am a cisgender, heterosexual, 41-year-old white man. What aspects of my background might in this moment make me treat somebody differently in terms of how much autonomy I'm giving them? Am I treating this person differently based on their gender identity or their race or their ethnicity or just the fact that they look like me? And reflexivity is kind of a constant check on what are the things that we're bringing to that moment. It doesn't fix the problem, but it brings it, it kind of moves it from the implicit world to the explicit world and lets us talk about it and think about it. And the second thing I think is to collect data on how we're doing. So if you're using something like entrustment supervision ratings, do you see differences between people of different identities and backgrounds? That's one clue that you are actually, you know, entrusting, which is kind of a form of supervision and related to autonomy, that you're treating people differently. And then asking learners their experiences, because as I said, autonomy is an experience. It's not necessarily a supervision level. And so asking our learners, hey, do you feel like you're getting the right amount of autonomy? Do you notice that you're being treated differently based on your identity or differently compared to other people with a different identity? I think that kind of experiential data is really powerful. And if we don't ask those questions, chances are we're never going to know.
One thing that Molly brought up that I think was great is what happens when we think about like our learners becoming supervisors. And let's say like you're the attending on the team for a senior resident and that person is supervising an intern or supervising a medical student, or in clinic, for example, I precept students, but I have a resident with me to kind of give them a chance to do co-precepting together. So in fact, kind of allowing them to promote that autonomy as well. How would you feel like those are different, or how do you coach, like, let's say the residents on your teams on inpatient to then help promote autonomy in their kind of supervisees? I mean, is it similarly like the communication, the four S's, the kind of allowing agency, or is there something different about it?
I think it's very transferable. So I think it's very similar principles. I also think giving someone the opportunity to try to give another person autonomy is a great way for people to get insight into their own autonomy. You know, if you're a senior resident and you're struggling with your own autonomy and maybe you're disagreeing with your attending or your fellow and how much they're jumping in and those kinds of things, and then you have to do that for someone else, you can see some of those struggle points from the other side. We talked about that kind of empathy gap that we sometimes have between a supervisor and a learner and how frustrating small moments that might seem innocuous to the supervisor might be, and how frustrating they are to the learner. When you flip those roles, the opposite plays out, and that can give them insights. Kind of like as an internist, when I rotated in the emergency department for the first time, and I realized how crazy it is down there and how hard it is to do everything exactly perfectly. And I stopped as a resident asking for the entire workup to be perfect before they were sent up to the floor, because I was like, oh, now I get it. I think allowing learners to try to be deliberate about their own practices with promoting autonomy in others can be very eye-opening for themselves when they say, oh, okay, now I get what my attending is trying to do to me. So I think the skills are transferable, and it's an empathy-building exercise to be on the other side of it.
And one thing that I think, Ben, you had kind of gotten our attention towards is the work of Claassen and kind of thinking about risk tolerance. And just wondering, you know, whether there's a space for kind of your peers, you know, shining a light on how much risk tolerance you're able to tolerate. And, or maybe the Medical College of Wisconsin kind of threw in like four S's in a T or four S's in an R or something to include that risk tolerance. But how do you feel like that kind of plays a role in promoting autonomy?
Yeah, it's huge, because if you have no risk tolerance, you're going to micromanage everything. And again, I would ask, why do you not have any risk tolerance? And a lot of times people can say, oh, it's because I got burned on this particular thing, or, I had a bad experience at one point. But if you're going to promote autonomy, you have to be willing to accept failures and errors that might occur. And you mentioned Dr. Claassen's work. If you want to have a really fascinating set of papers to read, just PubMed Jennifer Claassen's name and look at her PhD papers on failure. They are absolutely fascinating, because they're not just about failure. It's about supervisors letting their learners fail when in the moment they know that they are failing. And so you can imagine, like, that's part of giving someone autonomy. They have to take on that risk. And how do you choose and when do you choose to let somebody fail and watch them do it in real time instead of stepping in is a really fascinating thing that most of us don't actively think about. And so, I'll just mention in her writing, she talks about the things that'll influence that are, what's the risk to the patient? We want nothing bad to happen to the patient. That's probably first and foremost, but it does have to do with, how much risk is a supervisor willing to take, and what are my opinions of this learner and how they're going to manage this failure? And also, what is the culture of the place I'm at? What is the clinical context? So during COVID, I think a lot of us gave autonomy to our learners because we had to. We all kind of developed a different set of risk tolerance because we were working under extreme circumstances. Or, when you're overnight, we actually, at least here, accept more risk by having lesser supervision because that's how the hospital is staffed. And so all these things play a role. And when you see those failures happen and you actually let a failure happen, one of the things I think we can do better to keep promoting autonomy is to talk about that with our learners, to say, hey, that failure happened there, and not just debrief about the failure, but to say, I saw that failure happening and I let it happen. And here's why I let it happen, so that learners don't wonder, like, what the heck just happened there? Why did you let me make this wrong antibiotic choice? Why did you let that family conversation go off the rails? Why did you let me cut that fascial plane that was not quite right? And to be very transparent and explicit with that, I think creates a lot of safety for our learners to say, oh, okay, it's okay to fail. And if I do fail, my supervisor is going to know I'm failing and they're going to help me work through that whole thing. And I think it might make us as supervisors feel more comfortable with the risk of letting failure happen too, because one of the things we are all afraid of is being blamed for allowing a failure in a zero tolerance of failure culture. But the reality is, if we want to promote autonomy, we have to let some failures happen.
I feel like I'm still processing the fact that there are people out there who are letting people fail, knowing that they are failing, and they're like that much of a meta educator that they're able to kind of sit there and tolerate that. It's like when risk tolerance and autonomy promoting like come together and have a baby, and that is when failure is like allowed and then commented on and named, obviously in a way that, knock on wood, doesn't harm patients, but like let's kind of the learners sit with that. I'm still overwhelmed by that, because I would love to hear, like, Ben, in what you were just saying, there's data, there's this equity check, there's this reflexivity, like how do you find time and kind of the space to do those things while you're like letting someone fail? It almost feels like an impossible task, something, or maybe I should say it feels like an aspirational task for many people.
I totally agree with you. And I do not claim that I do it well. So I want to be clear about that in my moment of reflexivity. But what's interesting, when you read Dr. Klassen's work, she actually says that when she asked supervisors, how do you make those decisions? How do you decide when and how to let someone fail? Essentially, they all said, I don't know. It's kind of implicitly done. They talked about it being a feeling or a gestalt, like something that was not conscious to them, which resonates with me. I think we think about it, but a lot of it is very implicit, which, by the way, those kind of feeling and gestalt moments are when bias tends to sneak in and inequities happen. So that tells you this is like very fertile ground for problematic behavior. But then when people reflect back on those moments, they did have factors and deliberateness that were playing into it. It just happened so fast in such a heuristic way, they were not aware of it. So I don't even know if it's possible to be super, super deliberate and deliberately consider all the factors about when and how to let someone fail, because we're not computers. But I think one of the things that she recommends in her work is to take the different factors that she identified that go into those decisions, which are, again, patient safety, supervisor factors, learner factors, and context, and use that as a like vocabulary and framework to talk about these things. So if in a moment I am letting you fail, to say, hey, by the way, I let you fail because I perceived low risk to the patient. I thought that you had the identity formation and competence to handle this, and it would be a formative experience. I was comfortable helping you through it and cleaning up any consequences of it. And the context, this is the right clinical milieu to have it happen. Like giving that as a framework, I don't see it happening super well. And that's another thing that she found was when in her work, when she asked learners, how often do people talk to you explicitly about being allowed to fail? Essentially, all the learners said, nobody talks to me about this. No supervisor ever says, hey, I let you fail back there. Let's talk about that. Mm. It just kind of goes, gets lost in the wind, and it's never a discussion or growth point.
Are there some examples from her work that of what those failures look like? I mean, are we talking like Ira gives too much Synthroid and the patient gets suppressed, or are we talking like something much bigger?
I think they ran the gamut. And when the supervisors talked about it, most of the time they said the number one thing is it cannot be a failure that is going to have a significant consequence or harm to patients. That's how most supervisors were thinking about it. So it wasn't kind of a, I'm going to let you fail suturing this aortic laceration. It was more of a, you know, maybe I will let you choose a medication to start with. And, you know, we'll see if this antibiotic actually fixes the fever curve, even though it's not the one I would have chosen. Or I'll let you have this conversation with a family, even though maybe it didn't go exactly smoothly like I wanted to go. I didn't perceive that it was going to totally break trust with them in the medical system. So, you know, they talked about things like not letting the patient suffer too much, not being too dangerous. And I think some of the specific things were things like optimal wound healing strategies for skin incisions and, you know, needle sticks that were not high risk, stuff like that. Can you allow somebody to do those things that are not going to cause long-term damage and let them fail in the moment? And the place I see this in terms of a procedure as an internist, I don't do a ton of procedures, but is lumbar punctures, right? Like sometimes I see somebody lining up for that lumbar puncture and maybe that's not the interspace I would have chosen, or they're taking an approach that I think is safe, but maybe isn't exactly the way I would have done it. And you let it happen. And when they don't get the tap, you say, oh, well, you know, let's talk about why that happened. So as I reflect back, I do this too, but I have to be honest, I'm not always thinking in the moment I'm allowing a failure to happen. And I certainly don't do a great job of debriefing with my learners about it.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't call those necessarily a failure. Yeah, there's so many different styles and practices that you can certainly have. I could say, you know, that's not how I would have done it, but unless it's truly, truly wrong, which sounds like it's not really what they're allowing to have happen anyway. So I wonder if it's a framing.
I think in some cases it truly is like, I don't think this is going to work, but I'm going to let it play out. Or it might work, but there's a better chance that it won't work. But I think you're right. If you're going to cause overt harm, maybe you don't actually let that happen.
But I could see the application of this. Like, I'm just thinking kind of long-term. This feels like an aspirational thing on, let's say, potentially rounds or kind of in clinic precepting. And I almost wonder if this is something that, you know, the ACGME came out with their like clinician educator milestones. And I almost wonder if there's a component of this kind of autonomy promotion and almost awareness, like reflective practice to be aware of your own supervision level and promotion of autonomy that needs to be included. Because I could see somebody, you know, I do this, I think Molly, you do this too, like letting a resident or a student do a PAP when you're like, okay, that is literally not the direction I would go, but that's okay. You know, well, this patient, thank God.
You're not hurting the patient.
It does not appear to be in pain, or who knows? And maybe that's another place to do that reflexivity check to be like, do I think that I know that the patient is not in pain? But, you know, I can imagine a situation where you let that person fail and you kind of go through and say, here's why I took over. Here's why I kind of, this is the approach I took. But anyway, that's an example to say, I almost feel like this could be reconceptualized as a educator milestone, potentially. You know, we have milestones for autonomy and where, as you mentioned, like EPAs for learners, but like, where does this come back to us as faculty and educators? Like, are we doing this to a degree that we're allowing, you know, when the factors align, a degree of failure?
I love that idea. And I think that even if in the moment we don't have the cognitive like processing power to do all the things we're supposed to be doing and being so deliberate with managing failure, I think even having the competence to and the wherewithal to go back and debrief with your learner on the failure, not just to say like, how are you doing, but also to reflect and say, okay, that pap smear didn't go like it should have. Did I see it going wrong in the moment and I let it happen? Or did I think it was going to be okay and they were doing it right and it just didn't work out, which happens to all of us with different procedures or conversations. And if you let it happen, letting them know that you let it happen and why you let it happen. In her work, Dr. Claassen, the learners talked about this, that they, some of them were like, yeah, I knew my supervisor was letting me fail. And I didn't know why. And some of them actually talked about inferring that the supervisor was kind of malintended. Like they let me fail because they're a bad supervisor and they want to watch me like squirm. And unless we help fill that narrative in and say, I wasn't sure you were going to fail, but I thought you might fail. And here's why I let it happen, because it's a growth moment and a growth opportunity and it's okay. And let's talk about it. I think that is really helpful. And then sometimes failure happens and we didn't know it was going to happen, and saying like, hey, whoa, that didn't work out. I didn't know it was going to work out either. Like, I thought you were doing that pap smear correctly, or I thought that LP was perfect, and that happens too. But having that language and being deliberate about it would probably be a big step forward if that's all we do.
Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Thank you. I feel like we've covered so much. Are there any other like main points that you think we haven't touched on?
I guess I might just ask Ben, like for Rena specifically, if you're in this conversation with her and let's say she caught you in like a 5-minute hallway conversation, to put everything, all the juiciness that we've discussed today, you know, is there a way that you would frame this to her to specifically kind of promote, if her goal is really to promote autonomy for like interns and residents in the morning, medical students in the afternoon, or, you know, that general breakdown, what would you tell her?
Yeah, I think the first thing is you can never communicate too much about it. So being very open with your learners in terms of what they're looking for and what you're seeing with their behavior. I think being explicit about the difference between autonomy and supervision with our learners can be helpful to say, hey, I'm trying to give you agency and to give you space to make these decisions, and I'm going to observe and intervene when I think it's appropriate. And then I think some of those practical skills for people who are really struggling to know what does this look like those four S's we talked about, can sometimes be a nice kind of thing to fall back on in terms of, okay, what are the behaviors that I can actually enact in the clinical space with my learners? And I think they apply to residents or medical students to try to promote that kind of autonomy. And then the last thing is what we already talked about, that if and when you let learners fail, to be transparent about the fact that they were allowed to fail for the sake of autonomy and help them work through that and unpack all that. Those are the things I would say. And then I would say again, good job, Rena. Keep up the deliberate educator work.
Love your positivity. And thank you. That was a great summary. And I think really nice frameworks to think about broadly, but also really nice practical tips for day-to-day use. So thank you. Anything else that you want to plug? Anything? I know you already talked about a few things that you're working on, but anything we should be keeping an eye out, or publications coming out soon, or
trip to the Radical Lab?
Can I plug a personal thing?
Sure.
So my wife is a speech language pathologist, and she works at a school where most of the students are autistic. And one of her big interests is in stuttering. And she recently self-published a book called Ralph the Rooster, about a stuttering rooster. And the illustrations are done by a childhood friend of mine who actually changed my diapers when I was a baby and now is a good friend. He's an Academy Award nominated animator and was kind enough to do the illustrations. And it's just a really sweet book. And it is intended for anyone who might have a child that they wanted to talk to about stuttering and kind of some of the struggles that people can go through trying to figure out mechanisms to work through that. So if you're interested in a good children's book, or you know somebody who stutters and might be interested in reading it, it's called Ralph the Rooster by Maya Kinnear.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
Congratulations to her.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Well, this has been so great. We really appreciate it. I love thinking through this with you, and lots for me to keep unpacking and thinking about taking back to my practice.
Totally. Thanks for having me. What a fun discussion.
Thanks, Ben.
Ira, this was such a great conversation with Ben. I feel like I have so much to reflect on. Any main take-home points that stood out to you that you're going to try to bring into clinic next week?
Yes, I think, well, I mean everything, Molly, but I do feel that I need to work on kind of being a little bit more risk tolerant, we'll say, or at least naming the, I think, risk tolerance that I am or am not embodying in that moment. But specifically, aspirational for myself is kind of allowing, if the factors align, kind of allowing a moment of maybe aware failure. I don't know. I haven't coined a term yet or thought about how I would frame this to the learner, but I really am just totally shook and totally impressed and aspiring to a moment where I feel comfortable enough to say, I'm going to let this person see how this goes, and it's going to fail, and we will kind of deal with that and really illuminate the narrative when that happens. But still thinking about it. Molly, what about you?
Yeah. Like I mentioned during the conversation, I think just kind of that explicit question of, you know, where are you feeling like you need more help with, or where are you feeling like you want more autonomy in which clinical aspects, I think is just so simple and I'm going to give it a try and see how that works. I think Ben really highlighted nicely and just kind of in preparation for this, separating out autonomy and lack of supervision, I think really has made me look at this a little bit differently. Because like we were talking about at the beginning, I certainly felt like as a resident, I wanted less supervision and more autonomy. And I certainly equated those. But as an educator, I think it is really important to think about them slightly differently and think about how we can best support our learners. This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible, and to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at Podpace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoyblein.
We're committed to providing you with high-level and high-value practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. I'm Dr. Ira Krzyzanowska. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.